Accession number 31680, Reel 2.
Were you giving any thought to the possibility that you become involved yourself?
Only that it seems silly in a way, but only that I was quite keen to fly and to be a pilot, and I was rather saddened that I was going to have to wait so long. But I think I was only 17 when I went to some place in Penrith and asked to be to go in for flying training, and they said, well, they gave me a badge with that, and they put in your lapel and said it's going to be 18 months or so before you can get into this. And it was only subsequently that I heard of this University Air Squadron course and got onto that, really, which filled in some of the time. Because at the end of that course, in September 42, we then, all the people on that course and on others in Oxford and Cambridge and Edinburgh were the other main universities, I think, came to the Aircrew Reception Centre in St John's Wood here in London, where pretty well everybody who went into flying training came. It was amazing how organised. It must have all been thought out beforehand as a plan to carry out should it be necessary. Taking over of large blocks of flats in St John's Wood, just north of Regent's Park, as accommodation for all these people, and also the taking over of vacant accommodation in lots of seaside resorts like Scarborough, Torquay, Blackpool, to house, well, it was nearly all Air Force people, a house in this accommodation, and the landladies or the hotel owners were paid accordingly, no doubt. So they could all be accommodated really without putting up Nissan huts. It was all done with, or any other accommodation, it was all done by using these buildings. And we were at the Aircrew Reception Centre, we were all fed in the sort of cafeteria or restaurant of the zoo, of the London Zoological Gardens, whatever it is, London Zoo. And various other big buildings that people didn't want to have then because they thought they were not going to be bombed to bits. A lot of them were in London at the time. But one was the Baker Street offices of the major building societies at the Abbey National, I think, were taken over as a sort of medical processing centre for all these aircrew. So the man behind it was a chap who I'm quite interested in because he seemed to be a superb organiser and had done something similar in the previous war. And I have seen a book written by him, but I foolishly didn't buy it. And he was a man called Brigadier General Critchley. And he'd run the Greyhound Association at this sort of Greyhound tracks at White City, I think it is. And it was his idea to take over all this vacant accommodation that was going to be available, and then probably all made money out of it, I don't know, but it filled all needs. It filled the fact that people had accommodation they wanted to get out of because of prospective bombing. It used the accommodation, it kept the landladies happy in all these seaside resorts, and not all seaside. Others were spa towns like Stratford-on-Avon had an initial training wing, and Harrogate was a big personnel dispatch centre that I went to. So he was a bit of an organisational genius. Whether he thought it all out beforehand or not, I don't know. But I once went on a trip by a chap in Bristol who organises trips to air displays and to factories, mainly for people in the aviation industry, and who roped me into his clientele. And we went to this place, I think it was at Middle Wallop, which is an old Air Force and then Army Air Corps centre, and they had books on sale, and one of them was called Critch. And it's by Brigadier Critchley, and it's about what he did. Foolishly, I didn't buy it. It would have been an opportunity, but I missed it, really. I'm rambling on, I'm afraid.
Where was the bank that you were...
Well, it was the what was then the Westminster Bank. It became National Westminster, I think. National Westminster now, in Penrith, really. My father had his account there. I don't think he got me the job or anything. I think I know what happened there. I knew a chap at school who had gone there and then left to become a reporter on the local newspaper, and so I knew this vacancy was available, so I went and got there. He was a chap who had a flair for writing, perhaps encouraged by this same master I had, John Jackson, and became a writer for just the local newspaper. Really.
What sort of impact did the early war have on Cumbria and Penrith?
I suppose there was rationing. Some things were in short supply, but I didn't get the impression it was too bad, or that parts of the country must have been hit much more. I imagine. I don't know. The only thing I did at the very beginning was fire watching on a building when I was waiting to go in the for pilot training or to go on this University Air Squadron short course. And I don't know that very much happened. I remember on one day somebody probably must have thought it was a good idea to waken up Penrith to the fact there was a war on, because a lot of aircraft from Silloth, which is on the coast, where there was an operation, what I now realise was an operational training unit for from coastal command aircraft, but land-based ones. They came in Lockheed Hudson's, and I forget what, and they zoomed over the town in all directions. And why they picked on Penrith, I don't know, but it was the talk of the area for some time. I have a feeling that possibly the town clerk or somebody have said, you know, if you feel like shooting up this town, it'll wake them up a bit. Not that they were all doing a job and producing food and so on, but I think people were being called up and joined the service. A lot of people went into flying in the Air Force who were ahead of me in years, really. And one got the VC, really, by climbing out onto an aircraft's wing to put a fire out. I don't know how that was physically possible, but called Hutchinson, I don't know. But at any rate, there were these chaps who came back, and some of them had, burns and so on from Bomber Command there. So there was a generation of people just two or three years older than me, and some didn't come back at all. There was a very nice chap called Hugh Wilkinson, whose sister was at the school too, and his father ran a fishing tackle and a shop. Hugh Wilkinson, he could have been a pilot, I'm sure, but he went as a wireless operator and was killed fairly early on in the war. So there were casualties, often with people who in a way may have gone into the Air Force because of the kind of subject you studied at a grammar school like the one I had. I mean, they were very good on maths, and we knew about vectors and even trigonometry and cosines and tangents and stuff. And I now realise not everybody knew that or had gone through all that. So unintentionally, there was a lady maths teacher, Miss Rawlinson, probably got us all doing these things, and it led unintentionally into navigation and other things in the Air Force. I mean, I had other friends who, one was who was just ahead of me at school, became a navigator bomber wireless. It had to do navigation bombing course and wireless operating up to 12 words a minute, and flew. It would only go on one aircraft. It could only lead to one aircraft, and that was the bow fighter. And when they did anti-shipping strikes, many of the people on it were people in the Air Force from Holland or so. They knew Walcheron and the local inlets into Europe, and he had a highly exciting time shooting, shipping with rockets and so on. But out of 45 of them, I think only one, and he was the only survivor. And he became a pharmacist after the war. And then, but you know, you felt, well, they were great chaps and they did great things. My God, the attrition rate on some of them was terrible. I mean, there used to be a phrase about Bomber Command, Goodenough was convinced I was going into Bomber Command. It's an exciting time and everybody sticks together, but there's only one thing about it, there's no future in it. And that had a bit of a hollow ring, really. Not that I thought about it too much at the time, I just accepted it as, and that's it, you've got to go where they want you to go, that's why you were trained, I suppose.
What sort of condition was Durham in during your time there?
Well, in 1942, some interesting things happened. We were only the third course. They were every 6 months. So they'd been going for a year and they'd had 2 6-monthly courses. And the people on those courses, it was said, not all that many of them came back, really. I think they'd gone on to Bomber Command. But this third course, and it went on, they went on till after the war, really, as a means of recruitment into the Air Force, because I knew people who'd been on the 8th and 9th course way at 47 or 48 or something. Durham itself was a sort of centre for for mining and had a coal mining and had a strong labour tradition, very, very militant in a way, and perhaps put down all ills to capitalism and felt that the labour movement was, and socialism was the way out. But once Russia had entered the war, they all seemed to go along for support in the war, but there was this underlying, rather hard-bitten, had been through a lot of depression compared with the effects of depression compared with Penrith, I would say. The RAF short course was run jointly with Newcastle, which was then not a separate university but a division of Durham University. And the CEO of this university air squadron, who had got various gongs and done some climbing, he had lost a leg or something and had a big greyhound that he accompanied him, which was another bit of sort of bullshine that went on there, was based in Newcastle. And at the Durham end was the adjutant, who was a Scottish solicitor, who was quite influential with us all, because he really looked after us and he taught us Air Force law and Air Force administration and structure. And then there were some old hands from the Air Force. One of them had been flying over Dunkirk at the time of the evacuation, and as an air gunner, and he was in charge of all the marching and discipline and so on. And the armament, he told us about the Browning machine gun, so that you knew every. There's a phrase in some poem, I think it is, called "The Naming of Parts," and you had the way they thought it was. Be taught about the Browning machine gun is to name every little part, one of which was called the rear sear spring retainer keeper. In other words, every bit had something that was attached to it that prevented it from flying off or something. But you had to learn to strip it ridiculously, you had to strip it down and to overcome stoppages. I think that was the important thing. Not that I ever had to do it myself, but I mean, a wireless operator, air gunners would have had to.
Was your time at Durham then entirely academic and theoretical, or was there air time as time here as well?
We did a lot of marching and drill and physical training, and we did some flying. It was just sort of familiarization flying. Light aircraft, all sort of de Havilland moth things, but they weren't just the tiger moth, they were different sorts of, I've forgotten now, at some airfield near Newcastle. And then in the summer vacation period, which you didn't go down for, I mean, you just kept going, we were combined with the senior training corps, which was like an officer training corps, but for the army cadets. We went through a various kind of long marches and what I suppose would be orienteering with compasses and working your way over hillsides and so on, which was not strictly suitable for the Air Force possibly, but was all good stuff. It might have been useful if you'd been escaping as a prisoner of war or something. And we ran around, I remember running around with a bayonet and sticking it into a hanging bag of straw or something, which I didn't think was what I had imagined life was going to be like in the services, but there it was. I had to do it. Oh, and another thing that happened when I was there was as this would be 42, in the middle of 42, so it must be right from a date point of view, Hitler had these Baedeker raids where they taken the Baedeker guide to the UK. They decided to bomb the various places Germans would have visited or anybody would have visited during the war, and started with places like Bath and maybe Canterbury and so on. So it was, and York, and it was pretty clear that Durham was going to be about 3 or 4 days hence. Well, I've always thought everything worked slowly in this country, but my God, it worked quickly then. Army engineers and fire brigades appeared in Durham, has a place called Palace Green. At one end is the cathedral, 9th century. St. Augustine brought Christianity to it. At the other end is the castle, some of which is 9th century, a lot of it 12th century. Both World Heritage sites. Between it is this green and various university buildings. Well, onto it, one day came this bunch of engineers and they built a static water tank, which is as good as a reservoir from one side to the other in a circular thing and about 5 or 6 feet high. And then fire brigades came with all their pumps and they pumped water out of the river. All in, it seemed like in 24 or 48 hours, things happened in a way, my God, you couldn't have happened it quickly, more quickly. I was amazed. I thought, somebody's organized in this country and this must be it. And that was for this expected Baedeker raid. Well, the other thing they did, so that night, the night of the expected Baedeker raid, I was on the, with the other cadets, on the top of the roof of the castle with the stirrup pumps and things, hoping to counteract whatever happened. Well, they must have had some kind of mock lighting for Durham towards the coast, but at any rate, bombers came and unloaded a lot of stuff over towards, I don't know, well, you thought it was Thornbury-on-Tees or whatever, we didn't really know the direction. A whole lot of stuff, and nothing came on Durham that I ever saw, and so that particular Baedeker missed out on, really, but other cities were very badly damaged. That was the only exciting bit of, well, there were other exciting bits, but that was the most exciting bit, really.
Were you classed then as a full RAF recruit at Durham?
Well, no, I think we were really regarded. They didn't pay us, and I think we were really almost in air training corps uniform just for that 6 months, not till we got to St. John's Wood. And well, another thing they'd taken over in addition to the zoo for their food was Lord's Cricket Ground, and you were this was another Critchley thing. Obviously he was a genius. Perhaps other people had thought it have taken over stuff that isn't going to be used during the war on a big scale and using it for whatever, and you got your things issued, your new uniform in the Lord's Cricket Ground in the members' room or somewhere you'd never be able to get to at another time. So we were in this ATC uniform for afternoons, I think it was, and in the mornings we wore gowns. They still wore gowns as a student in Durham until midday, I think it was. So it was an introduction to university life, although as it happens I was on the science side, and we went to some science laboratories where they'd worked up about 48 experiments that you did, and then you wrote up by the usual method, you know, object, apparatus needed, method, results, conclusions in a sort of standardized form. And they were very good experiments on the different sorts of physics rather than chemistry. Some of them were quite simple, but they were quite good, really. I mean, one was a little, I remember, was a little wheel stuck on the front of an electric motor, and it was coloured in the different colours of the light spectrum, and so on. But when you turned it on, it all went white. And so I suppose all it was showing was that that light is made up. I don't know whether that was ever going to be a value to us. We did all these quite interesting experiments. We've got a wide range of perhaps rather shallow but interesting scientific knowledge, which I don't know whether I've used very much, but anyway, it's made me interested in things.
Was that meant to be specifically relating to
the Air Force? Yeah, well, they were devised by the academic staff at Durham for these courses. I think they were really, and they'd done similar courses at Oxford and Cambridge and at Edinburgh. And I think it was more just many of the aspects of some of the subjects were specific Air Force subjects, like navigation, which we did quite a reasonable level, I thought, and map reading as well, and meteorology, you know, cold fronts, the depression and the occluded fronts and so on, the stuff you see on the television, and Air Force law and aircraft recognition. There, one of the dons there had developed that by using what we also had in Canada, which was not just a projector that showed you the plan view and the forward view and the side view of aircraft, but he would put if you put it on a camera, a shutter system that at about a 100th, so that you would click on for a 100th of a second, and you either got what it was, it wasn't, so that you became adept at immediate recognition, which I suppose might have been what you would have had to have done in bomber command, whether it was a Fokker Wolf 190 coming at you or somebody in a Republic Thunderbolt or something, which would be a bit unlikely, but still. So it was an entertaining course. I mean, I suppose a lot of people in the war spent their time going on courses, and at one stage I felt that was happening to me, really, but I didn't mind that because I quite liked lapping up new ideas and new, you know, not just skills, but knowledge in a way.
How did you find a more military lifestyle and discipline?
Well, I suppose I was ready to accept the sort of square bashing and so on. I know a lot of people would not have liked that. I had no family tradition of doing that because my father was 12 had been in any of the services, but had other members of the family were younger who had been through all this sort of thing, and I don't know whether one regarded it as pointless or not. I don't think one did, really. I think one felt that you acted immediately in unison in situations where that was essential. But how necessary it is, I don't know. I mean, you were to be able to not only to march, but to go diagonal march in left incline, bang, and off you go, and it is something you're not likely to use very often, really.
After the course finished, then, how long were you in St. John's Wood for?
How long was it in the Air Force?
In St. John's Wood.
Oh, St. John's Wood. Well, very little time. I actually got it all in the back here, because you had to put it all in the back of your logbook somehow. Here. I was there for 2 months, really. Also, I'd discovered that I'd got a displaced septum in my nose, having fallen off a fence or something or other, and I had to go into up to Halton, where there was a hospital, RAF hospital, and have my nose rejigged or something. And then I went to a disposal wing, or that's a sort of just a distribution wing, in Brighton, where again they'd taken over magnificent hotels. One of them was the one where Mrs. Thatcher was, years later, almost to be killed, the Grand Hotel in the front. And next door to it was the Metropole Hotel, which was given over to medical and dental services. And I remember having all my teeth filled in the Metropole Hotel, looking out over the sea. And I met up with all some of my other colleagues who were, had done things while I was in hospital, getting my nose sorted out. And they then knew whether they were going to be pilots or navigators, because they'd gone through a thing called the grading school, which I was later to go on to. And this, the grading school was a system of deciding whether they thought anybody can be trained as a pilot, was their belief, but some can be trained as a pilot quickly enough for us to do it in wartime, and not everybody. And if you hadn't the aptitude to go solo in 10 hours, then you were going to be a navigator, or if you couldn't even cope with that, you'd become a bomb aimer. And some of the friends who were, you know, always thought themselves as it was then fighter pilots were the thing to be, thought of themselves as the fighter pilots of the future, to their horror, were going to be made navigators, but they all accepted it with a good grace, really. And I met up with them all again at Brighton. And then I went to this grading school myself, which was at Wolverhampton. It's a place called Codsall, which is now an industrial estate. And by then it was December.
42,
yes. And I went solo when I was about 8 hours or so, perhaps 10 hours. And 12 hours, 23 minutes. Oh, perhaps that includes the solo bit, yeah.
And what were you flying for that?
I was flying just a Tiger Moth DH-82A. And we were all in Nissan huts, and there were... The ground crew seemed to be civilian chaps, quite young people, probably waiting to be called up or something, really. And I remember a lot of Turkish officers with very long greatcoats who were going through this flying training at the same place. I don't know why they were there. I didn't ask, really. I looked up some relatives near there over Christmas. I was asked to... a party at some place. They were doing war work on some thing, and I was asked around to that. And
what was the process then of teaching you to
fly?
To fly solo.
Well, I think the first thing you do is go through familiar. Well, I mean, it's rather like what went on at the next stage, which was elementary flying. You do familiarisation. You sit in the aircraft, and instructor leaning over your shoulder, and he goes from left to right, you know, saying, this is the control that puts the fuel on and off, these are the ignition switches for the magneto, this is the blind flying panel, which has an artificial horizon, airspeed indicator, altimeter, the sort of turn and bank indicator, and then another one that shows that going up or down and the speed at which you're going up and down. And then other would be engines, things like engine revs on the engine. That's the speed at which it's turning, the air screw's turning. And oil temperature and oil pressure and fuel, important fuel, quantity of fuel you've got in the tank, really. And you'd learn drills of vital actions like what is it called?